This episode is brought to you by Audi Canada.
The Canadian Medical Association has partnered with Audi Canada to offer CMA members a preferred incentive on select vehicle models. Purchase any new qualifying Audi model and receive an additional cash incentive based on the purchase type. Details of the incentive program can be found at audiprofessional.ca. Explore the full line of vehicles available to suit your lifestyle. The Audi driving experience is like no other.
I'm Dr. Dorian Deschauer, Associate Editor of the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Shane Nielsen, who is a disabled poet, physician, and critic. Shane completed his PhD in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in 2018. He recently received the Governor General's Gold Medal for his dissertation in Disability Studies and the Regional Dean's Award of Excellence in Medical Education for his work on disability in McMaster University's medical faculty. Shane has written a compelling article on ableism in the medical profession and is joining me today from his home in Oakville. Good morning, Shane.
Hey, Dorian. How are you doing?
Good. So listen, I just wonder if we could start off by clarifying what you mean when you use the word ableism. And that's going to segue us to move on to the bigger picture, which is, if I understand your argument correctly, really about improving the way we work together as doctors. But it's even bigger than that. It's about building a better society. So let's start right here with a basic definition. What do you mean when you use the word ableism?
The definition of the term is Freudian, I think. Different people will ascribe different meanings to the word. I've even seen in disability studies contexts, it mean the opposite of what I thought it to mean. But I do have a definition, and I defined it on purpose in a book that I published last year called Constructive Negativity, Prize Culture, Evaluation, and Disability in Canadian Poetry. It's the very first book of literary criticism published in Canada devoted to disabled writers. So I figured I had to have a definition in that, and I'll just read that to you. So ableism is a constellation of ideas, beliefs, and practices that marginalize ill, non-neurotypical, and non-normative bodies. Ableism prefers not to be called what it is, mainly through the organization of social space, such that persons who are unwell or who require certain physical accommodations in order to participate in that space are not present, leaving those inclined to detect ableism out of the room. The physical fact of ableism in the course of Canadian life is obvious, something that can be seen at a glance at ubiquitous non-AODA conforming structures. That's one definition. In a shorter form, ableism could be described as the both conscious and unconscious prejudice directed towards people who are unwell or who do not have normative bodies.
Now, in your powerful article, you mentioned that ableism is something you've had to negotiate and resist all your life. Can you tell me why that is and what your experience has been like?
This is an intergenerational story. It doesn't begin with me. It begins several generations back. But what I do know is that my grandmother was non-neurotypical. And we're talking about someone who lived in the St. John River Valley in rural New Brunswick. So resources were few. And the identification of such things was rare. Anyway, she was unwell. And eventually she was recognized to have bipolar disorder and was treated later on in her life with lithium, and that made quite a significant difference. But she gave birth to my father, who also was non-neurotypical. He had a career in illness, which I really understand better now as a 44-year-old person, a few years after his death. He was bipolar as well, but never recognized as such because that would have been admitting to weakness or some sort of problem. So he lived very chaotic, sometimes violent, and very dramatically fraught life, but was always kind of perceived by others as being bad. You know, he was a bad man. And I can't contest that either, because that's also so. But the trick is, there wasn't a vocabulary or a compassion directed towards him such that his particular needs were identified and treated. So that's how things start. I'm the son of such a person, raised in a violent mentally ill kind of environment. And so I was born strange, so to speak, and was never identified myself for being so, because to do so would, of course, admit that I was somehow, my father and my mother would have had to recognize that, you know, I was strange, and that would have carried social stigma outside the home. I mean, I'm just surmising this because I haven't had the chance, unfortunately, to talk to them about this after their deaths. It's kind of an awakening that I've had afterwards, right? But anyway, moving quickly forward, extensive bullying in school for being me. Moving on to medical school, in which I was flagrantly unwell with bipolar disorder, cycling through all the years of my training. Recognized as bad without any sort of compassionate gesture towards help, save for a few well-disposed people within the faculty. It was a pretty negative experience. I still experience a little bit of a shudder looking back. And now that I've finally, to conclude, now that I've successfully been identified, I guess, and have successfully been treated, that doesn't mean that things are better. So this is one of the things I think that medicine wants to vent to itself as some sort of success story. It wants to say, you know, we can identify illness and then we can treat it. And if we treat it, then, you know, that person can go on and be well and be productive and be functional. But as many of us also know, the story isn't so simple, and that chronic illness can endure despite treatment with medication. And so I'm altered, I would say, towards the world based on my speech, based on my patterns of speech and the long paragraphical bubbles in which I talk, and based on, you know, still symptoms poking through, not just poking through, I guess. That's kind of the wrong metaphor. That's still enmeshed that metaphor in the old thinking. It's more like the strangeness is a fabric of myself. It's always been there and always will be. And I don't look upon my current state of being as something that needs to be medicalized out of existence.
So it sounds like you're bringing to the conversation a different idea or a different concept of what it means to be healthy. It's that healthy isn't just a pristine state, but it's rather something that you, or perhaps, I guess, like all of us, have to win and lose through the course of our life. You mentioned this strangeness, this feeling. Did you mean by that your sense of the experience of medication changing the way you think in some way, or changing your experience in life? Or what did you mean by that?
It's a hard question to answer, because for the longest time, I thought that my entire self could be described accurately or summed up adequately under a category provided to me by the DSM, right? So I was someone who had, you know, bipolar 1 disorder, and that therefore was the lens with which to view my previous behavior and my current self and my future self. But it's no longer the way, it's of course no longer the way that I view the way I negotiate the world, because it's so utterly simplistic. And this isn't, you know, of course, a new idea. There's been lots of theories of wellness, and, you know, there's ideas that say we're currently a balance. It's an equilibrium between wellness and illness. It's not completely 100% binaristically one or the other.
What I was getting at, though, and I wanted to push a little bit on this, because I know a lot of people as well have asked this question of what role do medications play in changing ourself or our perception of ourself? And has this journey of you that you've taken, has that sort of brought you to perceive yourself differently depending on what how you engage, say, with the products of biotechnology?
Well, you know, I do have some anti-psychiatry colleagues, right? So,
yeah,
I do. And I don't know. I mean, there's lots to criticize in all brands of medicine, but I can't say that medications have changed my personality. If anything, they kept me alive, because if I hadn't subscribed to taking them, then I would still be on that very difficult trajectory that I allude to in the piece, you know, in which during my third year of residency in the emergency department in Halifax, actually jumped off a balcony. So I'm glad that the medicine is there to prevent things like that. I do know though that I have many, many, many other people. I know many others, not necessarily anti-psychiatry individuals who are radicalized, or even academics who subscribe to the same ideas. But I know many other people with lived experience of mental illness, both schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major mental illness, schizoaffective disorder, who do attest to the medications changing fundamentally their sense of self. But that's not been my experience per se. So that's not me.
I'm curious about how you became an activist for patients, but also for doctors with disability. And yeah. I think that's a huge shift in how you're perceived increasingly in Canadian medicine. And how did that come about?
I'm ready to answer this one. I'm laughing because, you know, it's been a whole life spent under the boot of being misperceived, attributed to be hostile or negative, but really just being socially on the outside of things, and as a result, the negative perceptions intensifying. There's so many instances I can tell you about, anecdotes in which I have been, and I will use the word oppressed, that I've taken that energy and directed it towards constructive activities that I can do myself to aid the plight of my people who are the mentally ill. So what do I do? Well, one thing I do is I am the director of the Abel Hamilton Poetry Festival. It's a disability poetics festival that runs every year. It's run 2 years in a row, and this would be its third year in the fall. And what we do is we get disabled poets from all around. We've had them from New Brunswick, and we've had poets from all around Ontario. We get them to venues in Toronto, Hamilton, and Guelph, and we get them reading their work. And it's the very first disability-related specific literary festival held in the nation, to our knowledge. So I'm proud of that. The other thing I do is I will routinely write, or I have been writing over the past couple of years, articles in a medical context designed to trouble the concept of disability. So there's an article coming out in, I think it's just published now, although I don't have the book because, you know, COVID. Got an article coming out in a Routledge text edited by Andrea Carice and Paul Crawford. About the biomedical epistemology, neoliberalism, and Vincent Lamb, kind of troubling the story that medicine tells itself about what health is and what disability is, and what, especially what burnout is. So I do a bunch of stuff. Those are just a couple of things I do. But I do, especially, and this is the thing I'd land on, is I try to be myself, which is hard, in medical contexts that are preconditionally hostile to anyone who is not presenting as normal. Like, I don't know, do you do medical school interviews?
I don't.
Yeah,
I
well, don't. They have the MMI, the multiple mini interview format that many medical schools use, in which, you know, you sit in front of some interviewers in different stations, and you move quickly, and you have to provide very quick, concise answers to pertinent questions. That would slay me. I would get sliced to pieces by that. I would find it very difficult to process that kind of information at that kind of speed or rapidity, and be able to recapitulate, you know, the right answer, give the right answer, have a tight, concise answer, as you're probably as you're probably seeing, if five different things or eight different things. I wouldn't be able to. I wouldn't get into medical school now, because of the way that things are structured. And so I really find it important to be different and be in medical context and still practice medicine in a conscientious way, compassionate way.
So far we're really talking a lot about this kind of idealized, standardized person, if you would. And we're talking about standardized testing, so it creates sort of a standardized type of physician, which is interesting into itself. And we're going to come back to that and the implications for the medical workplace, quite honestly.
Yeah.
But I wanted to touch on physical disability for a moment, because I know a lot of our listeners will be dealing with physical disabilities. So does the stuff we're talking about here today apply equally to physical disabilities, or is it something we should bracket out and say, well, that's a whole slightly different topic?
I think all is welcome under the sign of disability. And of course, there's a relationship between both. And I think that it's part of to segregate them completely is part of a kind of the medical enterprise in itself, biomedicine, script, the Cartesian duality, between the body and the mind. I think it's a mistake. There's a fundamental interrelationship. But then there's also the practical heuristic saying these two can be separated and there are different somewhat. So I think that my answer is both yes and no. I'd also say that I'm going to maybe take a risk, but I'm going to say that the physical disability element is largely a matter of accommodation that people understand. So if there's lacking accommodation, I'm not saying it's instantly given, and I'm definitely not saying it's pre-given, because there's lots of work that still needs to be done in medical context with regards to certain disabilities, of which there's a Canadian Medical Disability Association, Canadian Association of Disabled Physicians, CADP, who looks at these sorts of things and talks about these sorts of things. But I think that on some level, it just makes more sense and to someone, the average kind of physician or the average person, on an accommodating level for a physical disability, there should be elevators, there should be wheelchair accessible bathrooms. These are things that people fundamentally get inside. And I think that the stigmatization of physical disability, although this isn't a blanket statement, I think it's largely true, is less. But there is something really threatening at the heart of mental illness and invisible disability of that sort. There's some sort of legitimacy question, some sort of lack of agency, some threat. And I think that stigma carries forward. And so in medical schools, I routinely will talk. People will come to me and they'll talk about their struggles. The students will. And they are absolutely terrified of declaring to institutional power, both regulatory at the college level and also within the medical school, that they're struggling. And the reason why is simple. They know what'll happen, right? They have a thought about what'll happen. They're largely overstating it, but I can't say they're wrong. That stigma is powerful. And I think that there are reasons why people are unwilling to disclose. And I think that has major consequences for the profession. And if that's true with the kids or the young people in school, that carries forward throughout the remainder of professional life, as people in the physician's health program know.
You're hitting something really fascinating, and a bit of a spoiler alert coming back to that body mind duality. And if we're moving ahead basically to talk about the more subtle administrative concepts that make up medicine and that govern us, let's put it this way. It's easier to talk about putting in a ramp for a building or an elevator for a building, and we can actually see that quite clearly. But it's not so easy to talk about how licensing bodies or our administrative bodies, especially in a safety sensitive occupation like medicine, or profession like medicine, how governance works, which is really about surveillance for risk. And I wonder if you could talk about that, not only say among physicians, you could talk about airline pilots, for example. How do you manage risk and balance public safety with creating a more inclusive, compassionate workplace?
I don't have a discrete answer, which could be immediately implemented across the land, but I do have some words that could perhaps guide the principles with which such could occur. And I would make a critique first to start off with, and to state that the very language that is being used around safety and risk management is fundamentally unsafe for people like myself. It will be used to oppress us. That may not fly from the college regulator, but that is the truth. It will be used to oppress us. There will be reasons and rationales and justifications that will become codified that will eventually result in us not being able to do what we would like to do and curtailing our professional and personal freedom.
So let's unpack that, because I think that's the huge, huge and fascinating set of problems you're bringing up. Say if you identify yourself as having a mental health disability, you're automatically put under the microscope. So anything at all that seems even the slightest bit out of a regulated norm, or could be perceived as out of the norm, could be jumped on as deviant. Is that what you're kind of getting at there, or am I missing the point?
I don't think that's wrong. I also think like the way you're phrasing it is, it seems like it's being set up to be extreme or almost an exponent placed on paranoia. But I do think that based on the lived experience that I have, one could say, well, that's extreme for anyone with mental illness, but it wouldn't be extreme for anyone who has had a particular career of mental illness of a particular sort and been to certain places and finds themselves within that regime and then can never escape from it based on the fact that the regulator is thinking it's doing good. But I just want to give you like an example. I'll give you a very practical example so that you can understand what I mean. And it relates to an earlier question that you asked around some of the things that I'm doing in terms of disability activism. First of all, I think that it's important to do this kind of work in one's own kitchen, so to speak, one's own home, one's own immediate location. So along with another physician at the University of Guelph and a partner that you may know, Juveri Zahir at in Toronto, we became concerned about the use of the use of handcuffs and physical restraints for patients coming to our facility seeking help, self-selecting for help. For suicidality, we became really concerned about that practice, and so we tried to change institutional practice in that regard, and we wrote a piece which challenged the use of handcuffs in our local facility. That's a risky thing to do, because you know you're going against the grain of the institution. But the point that I want to make is embedded within the research that we did. And over and over and over and over and over again, in all the police documents that we read concerning the use of restraint policy when transferring patients to hospital and just simply apprehending people under the Mental Health Act, the rhetoric of safety kept popping up. And when it turns to safety, there's only one safe thing to do. It's to restrain. It's to intervene. When it becomes safety, it becomes quite complex. It's not necessarily so much about the safety of the person being transported anymore. It becomes the safety of the transporter. And then when we think of the safety of the transporter, we're no longer in the realm of clinical care, right? We're thinking something else. We're thinking about something else. So I do think that the language around safety can become troublesome, but at the very same time, I recognize that the public needs to be protected. Absolutely. And that's the tricky balance. So finally, alighting on my one suggestion, my one kind of guidance principle for the good people of the Physicians Health Program in its various instantiations across Canada and North America, it would be to have somebody informed with disability studies background, somebody with lived experience of both kinds of, you know, so-called binaristic kinds of physical and mental. I'd recommend that they have somebody there with that kind of knowledge so that medicine can know what it doesn't know. Because, you know, if we don't know what we don't know, then things won't change. We'll proceed along this line of surveillance.
Well, that's kind of what I'm thinking, that you're well positioned. You and other people who deal with mental health disabilities are in a great position to talk about, for example, what's a physician in particular, what's a physician's ability to simply say, I'm not okay, I can't work, and I'm fine to do that reliably. I don't need an excessive surveillance, perhaps. Is that kind of where you're going, like kind of calibrate the system, make it more or less punitive? What could you imagine as, if you could wave a magic wand and have more lived experience informing policies, what might that look like?
That's tricky too. So, I mean, I've got another answer. I don't know if it results in it's not a magic wand answer, but it's kind of a dream of mine. So on the regulatory level, having somebody in tune with these issues from a disability justice perspective, I think would be very helpful. But in terms of the specific question you're asking about medicine more broadly, we have to come up against that thing called stigma. And if we actually changed things for physicians such that they could acknowledge that they were seeking help without fear of the regulator, which is a real thing, as you know, then I think that we would win. That would be the win. So physicians would feel comfortable being able to seek the help that they rarely, you know, kind of access. How do we do that? I think that's a multi-pronged campaign. You know, I think that's really a tricky one. And I have a small way for that to occur. That's my own kind of idea. And that would be by, once again, creating within medical faculties meaningful humanities infrastructure to promote these ideas, to critique medicine from within the inside in a constructive and not antagonistic fashion, to get scholars in the institution to point things out, to give medicine basically a signal from within its belly that maybe something is amiss and that things should change. That would be my suggestion. So creating like a center or institute or whatever it might be, or a department in which scholars of disability studies, but also medical architecture and getting the medical sociologists involved. And of course, probably relying upon the historians who are already there, science and technology studies like yourself, all sorts of different social science and humanities disciplines together to let medicine change for the better from within. I think that would be ideal, but that's not clearly the case anywhere in Canada.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you have some fascinating ideas for reform, and reform is possible. I mean, medicine has gone through major reforms, say in the 1950s, creating clinical trials as a way of framing knowledge. And this sounds like a new kind of reform that's gaining traction, perhaps. And for safety sensitive jobs, I still wonder if we can even look to other professions, say the pilots, for example, who made major changes in the way they deal with pilots with mental health disabilities after the German Wings catastrophe.
Right.
And I understand that that taking an antidepressant, for example, was frowned upon to the point that you could be disallowed from flying. So many doctors, many pilots actually went without, or certainly wouldn't talk about their issues. And that's changed.
It has, but we have a special resistance, right? We have a very special resistance. So I'm glad to hear that. And I think that's cheering. And that makes sense. In medicine, though, there is this intensified resistance. It is our business as doctors to, you know, it's the way we're trained. It's kind of our epistemological basis is to sort and divide normal into abnormal.
Yes.
And
yes.
There's a strange kind of... medicine is in that sense a bastion and also a single sender of normativity, you know. So we have a greater inner kind of resistance to such change, but I still think we could make it. I do think though that it's not the pilots aren't it's not their business to be the arbiters of what mental illness is and what it does, much, you know, whereas we are, that is more so our domain.
Yeah, doctors are in an unusual position. So that kind of leads me to my next question then. So if you were to have some advice for people with mental health disabilities, either as patients or as learners who are encountering the medical system, what would that advice be?
Oh, this is the sad part I have to say. What would my advice be to someone entering a place that's oriented against them? As much as things have changed, I must say this, when I being a bit elliptical, but when I started as an assistant clinical professor at McMaster a few years ago, I did so very warily, you know, very warily, because I had such a terrible time when I was being trained. But I wanted to, you know, join the faculty, and I wanted to do this stuff that I'm doing now, you know. So I met with someone who interviewed me and decided if I was appropriate and proper enough, I guess. And in the course of that discussion, I asked a few questions which were designed to see just what would the fate be for someone who was struggling. And the way that such hypothetical people were discussed was compassionate. It was a strange experience, because I had seen someone in authority discuss the plight of struggling people in a way that, you know, I would have myself wanted to be spoken of. So I got to say that although I have this very, very negative experience that's historical, it's 1996 to 2000, I'm cheered to say that things have improved quite substantially for the people who are struggling. It's no longer, I think, a intense pathologization as it was back when. That being said, though, what advice do I have? I have two kinds of advice. I have advice that's that I'd love to be able to give, you know, which would be, if you are struggling with a problem, then please seek help from the student affairs dean, you know. Please access campus resources around mental health. Typically, medical faculties will have their own special counselor designated from the university. Oh, please do that, is what I would say. But realistically, would I encourage someone to seek out help, knowing the stigma that exists and the fears that individuals have? And I think they're not invalid around the match and future success.
Hmm.
I, you know, that's troublesome. But I can say though that if there is a problem, if there is a, but even that word, I don't know if it's right. If someone's suffering from something, I don't even know if that word's right. Like, the eventually you study enough and you begin to problematize every single word that exists. If there is an issue, and it's not addressed, it will grow. It will grow probably, and it will become the thing that that becomes something that's too powerful for you. So if there is a way to address it, please try. Because I think at some point during our training, at some point in our lives, we walk past opportunities and we just have to notice that they're there. And they're often just based in a conversation or saying something or responding to compassion when it's directed towards one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe just saying yes when the opportunity comes towards you, maybe that's a piece of advice I would give.
Well, thanks for being honest about that. Well, we're coming to close to the end of our interview, but I don't think we can end the conversation without talking about COVID-19. Now, my wife and I are fortunate enough to be able to work from home. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners the impact of the pandemic on your life.
It's been interesting, you know, all sorts of things that were thought impossible are now possible, apparently, by this COVID. In terms of the way medicine is being delivered and administered, it just took the viral apocalypse for us to change, I guess. So, you know, we're now much more available. We'll phone people. We'll talk to them through the computer. I've signed up for an account on doxy.me at the behest of another physician who showed me how to use it. And that looks pretty good. I'm going to get that going, especially for my patients with mental illness, of which forms the bulk of my practice at the University of Guelph. Right now I'm doing things by phone, but there's the occasional in-person visit, and those are extremely rarely given now. We're really trying to limit the entry of the virus into our clinic. I was, you know, doing walk-in shifts. That's not a longer thing. You know, so most of my stuff is done by phone now, and I'm getting the computer ready to deliver things that way. But the other big change is having two young children, like one son who's disabled and my three-year-old daughter, and having to juggle care of those two kids who are small and require a lot with my wife, who's also home, working from home. And oh, it's been a real strain. I was going to add, though, I was thinking, one last thing about what else I would do to recommend the person who is suffering from something. And it would be just keep an eye out also for other individuals who are suffering. That's probably the greatest, that's probably the easiest form of community one can form. There's, of course, one's fellow trainees, in which you know a lot more of, but there's the occasional staff person too, who you'll hear things about, or all practicing person. Just keep an eye out for people who seem to have the same thing and try to rely upon their expertise and knowledge. And eventually I think you'll be able to negotiate the more formal realms of that. I would say also, it's not the wrong thing to do to contact things like the Physicians Health Program. I did that, I did that myself to get better. But of course, you know, the writing was on the wall that I needed that. Or I got to say, they are not about punishment. They're entirely about, at least my experience was, they're entirely about getting you better. You know, they look upon it that way and getting you able to practice in a health and safe, so-called, you know, I don't like the word, but safe way. So I don't want to demonize that program, which has given me quite a lot and is, you know, responsible for me still being here. I want to encourage people who think about doing so, probably that's a sign that you should do so. But I also want to balance that with the knowledge that it brings some pretty significant consequences. The good news is, though, that once you do it, you begin to not care, or you care less, because you got your life and, you know, it's no longer threatened. So you get something out of the deal.
And well, I guess I just want to remind our listeners, we're talking here in Ontario, but of course this is a national medical journal. So every province has its own physician health program. Is that correct? Or almost every province?
I know of many, and I think that there is its equivalent in every province, but I do think my knowledge of the programs in the East Coast is they may go by other names. Yeah. But I think there's basically that function. Yeah. What are you doing with COVID, Dorian?
I am hunkered down. I work with a team called the Inner City Health Associates, which provides medical care to homeless shelters in Toronto. And I work in a shared care family physician clinic. So those clinics have moved as much as possible to the online format as well. And I'm kind of getting used to it and learning the pros and cons of telephone calls, video, and getting onto OTN. So very much echoing your experience.
Are you enjoying it?
Tell you the truth, I find I'm getting used to it. I like the in-person. I was unaware of how much we get from how much I rely on body language and that visual communication to connect with someone. And I find it a lot more work, to be honest, just dealing with the voice. So I'm still getting my head around it, learning and open to the possibility that this medium has potential, but I'm certainly not there yet. So, well, Shane, thank you very much for this wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking with Dr. Shane Nielsen. To read the Medicine and Society article he wrote, visit cmaj.ca. Also, don't forget to subscribe to CMAJ podcasts on SoundCloud or a podcast app, and let us know how we're doing by leaving a rating. I'm Dr. Dorian Deschauer, Associate Editor for CMAJ. Thank you for listening.